Good afternoon, everybody. This is the Senate Interim Committee on Healthcare, and I welcome everyone here. It is 1 o'clock Wednesday, and we're ready to go. I want to let everyone know that we have, it's sort of jam-packed today, and right after this, we are going to be making a tour at Ambulatory Surgical Center, and that's extremely important. We've been trying to schedule this for a year, over a year, and it's been so hard to get committee members organized enough, but we do want to make sure we get out of here in a timely manner, as well as be able to do the tour and then get back for the reception for Senator Margaret Carter at 4:30. So it is fairly busy. So with that, right to begin with, I want to go over two of the legislative concepts. That we're going to be hearing when session starts in February. And with that, I would like to open a work session, basically, on LC9. And before you introduce to accept, I'd like to have some comments. LC9 is actually relating to prescriptive authority for licensed psychologists. And with that, I would like to call Donna Silverberg. Yes. I always want to say Silver Moon.
Yeah, of course.
And then Laura Smith and John McCauley, if you would like to come up also.
Familiar-looking group of people.
I am not. Are you?
Oh, yeah. Robin's taking the place of Laura. Mm-hmm. All right. All right. Introduce yourself for the record, because we are on live throughout the entire nation.
Okay. Mm-hmm. The entire nation. That's good. Thank you for sharing that. My name is Donna Silverberg, and I am a mediator facilitator out of Portland. I was working on this project through the Oregon Consensus Program through PSU. Madam Chair, members of the committee, it's wonderful to be here with you today to talk about the work of House Bill 2702, the work group on prescriptive authority for licensed psychologists. The group has reviewed the report that I have there before you, and all agree with the report, what's in this report. So I will speak from the report. They asked me to be the person who spoke on behalf of their work today. If you have technical questions about the draft, these folks can answer those questions. I'm here to talk mostly about the process. I can tell you that the group worked very hard on this effort. You'll see in this report on page 4 the folks who were on the work group and where they came from. So these are people who spend a lot of time doing a lot of other things, and they were very well prepared for the work here. They worked hard to understand the differences of each other and other people who provided input into the issue that they were discussing. And in doing their work, they discussed all sides of the issue. They discussed the pros and cons of providing the authority, focusing entirely on what if this were to move forward, what should the training education requirements be for psychologists in addition to the license that they come in with? What additionally should they have added to their background? What kind of oversight should happen? And how do you through all of this provide collaborative care between the medical and mental health professions? At the end of the day, while there were things that they didn't agree completely on throughout, they did agree that the draft that's before you is something, they did have a consensus that the draft language was acceptable for all the people in the work group if this were to move forward. So,
and for the record, that's one pharmacist, one primary care physician, two psychiatrists, and three psychologists.
That's right. Thank you. Right. So the background of this, as you know, House Bill 2702 that you all passed in the 2009 session asked this group to develop the recommendations on the training program that would enable psychologists to safely prescribe medications for certain mental illnesses, to evaluate the training that would be necessary to allow that for special populations, to develop legislative changes for the current current statutes to provide the oversight, and then talk about the cost of implementing the program. The group met for 5 meetings between September and December, and we had a call on Monday of this week for our 6th meeting. We designed this process to allow these folks first to get grounded in what the substance was from all perspectives. They were each coming from their own, you know, whether it was a psychiatrist MD position or a psychologist or, as Ann Hamer, who's sitting here, a psychopharmacologist. They had different understandings, and so we set it up so they could get grounded in what that information was, then figure out together what kind of curricula, what did they need to look at, what information did they need to look at, and then process that information and finally produce the draft that you have as LC9. At the start of its work in their processing, they did agree that these would be they would be confidential conversations, that they were going to work in a quiet work session, really enable themselves to have an open and robust conversation where they could call each other without having things reported elsewhere. They were really quite open with one another. They listened well to one another. It was really an impressive group. At the request of others outside of the group decided to have a public comment period. And so from December 28th to January 8th, small window but meaningful, they put out the language for public comment. And at the back of my report, you'll see the people who commented and provided input during the work sessions, and then also on the draft language that we have before you there. The group reviewed, as I said, a good deal of substantive information. If you look at page 2 of my report, the background information on curricula was looking at related training in other areas that have enabled prescribing medication. So we looked at the APA model curriculum, OHSU psychiatry residency curriculum, the psychiatric mental health nurse practitioner curriculum, Master of Clinical Health Services degree curriculum, physician's assistant curriculum, Alliance International's curriculum out of California, the Oregon Council on Naturopathic Physicians Formulary, and the U.S. Armed Services Psychopharmacology curriculum. So they looked at these things in depth. From those, they pulled the things that they thought were most useful. They left the things that they didn't think were that useful for this, and that is part of what's in the ideas that they've got forward here with the curriculum and training portion of the bill. For statutory language, they looked at the House Bill 2702 and its precursor, the one before the work group. Also, statutes in New Mexico and Louisiana, which are the only 2 states currently that have this authority available. They also looked at House Bill 2800 from the 2007 legislative session, and then measures, the House Bill 2345 and staff measure summary from your 2009 session. Finally, they did look at the input received from the outside the work group, both during their conversations and then on the drafts that they had put forward for public comment, as well as some fiscal impact statements. So the first 5 meetings led to a draft report that included an intent for a collaborative relationship. There's a preamble that it has the collaborative relationship. Since Monday, since recently, they have tightened that up a little more. You will see another draft. LC is working on that. You should get that soon. Tightened up more about the collaborative relationship, which really says that physicians and psychologists should be working together on these sorts of decisions about prescribing, that the psychologist would be able to make the prescription, but they'll be working collaboratively with a physician. So the collaborative relationship that they talked about during these meetings was not just between an individual physician and psychologist, but also at a meta level between the boards of the Oregon Medical Board and also the Board of Psychologists Examiners. Thanks. So really trying to through this conversation, have more of that collaborative conversation that all of the committee felt was important. They added this additional curriculum and training that they felt was needed. They added an oversight of the certification process as well as oversight of discipline. And at the end of all of these conversations, decided while they looked through all of the input that came in, some very, very thoughtful input came in on the draft legislation, they felt that all of the points that had been raised in the input that they got from the public were points that they had thoroughly discussed in the committee. And they felt that at the end of the day, the bill that they had was the best acceptable for all the sides that were present. So to get that group to agree, that was the best that they could do, was the bill that you have with the most recent changes. So finally, I just want to say that, you know, the work group took their charge very seriously to focus on these issues. They developed the recommended training and education to support what they felt would be a safe way to support people prescribing medication. They established a collaborative relationship and oversight by the medical board and the board of psychologist examiners. They provided a process for administering all of this, for requests for licenses and disputes that might arise through all of this. And the only thing that they chose to ask for other additional help was on the costs, that the costs that they saw related to all of this were mostly administrative that would be for the state agency, and felt that the Legislative Fiscal Office would be in a better position to answer that question than a group of physicians and psychologists and pharmacists. And finally, I just want to say that, you know, this was a group of extraordinarily thoughtful, respectful, highly engaged individuals that approached this process with high integrity. They're dedicated to the job and to try and work through some of the tough spots that they had together. Even in those times when they didn't see things the same way, they worked through them, and at the end of the day were able to create something that met their individual high standards for what is right, and also create together what they felt would be the best option for Oregon if psychologists are to be allowed to prescribe. So thank you for your time today. Thank you for allowing me to work with this group. It was really an honor, and I really appreciate the work of the work group themselves. I've got Robin Henderson was a work group member. Ann Hamer was our psychopharmacologist. And Linnea is back there, was one of our other psychologists on the group as well. I don't know if anyone else has shown up while I've been sitting here. So that's my
report. That's wonderful. So I was very impressed with the process, and I was very impressed with the professionalism of the members of the committee and the work. I was able to attend meeting and then called in when it was available, conference call. And it looks like the education and training, there's no question on either side that was definitely, there was total consensus on training and education. Then when it comes to oversight, the oversight was a huge change, I felt, because oversight now is under the Oregon Medical Board. Mm-hmm. And so the Oregon Medical Board would be able to deny or vouch for the certificates for those who are applying for a license to prescribe. And so this committee on prescribing psychologists, that will be under the Oregon Medical Board in this draft, and there would be 4 psychologists on this committee and 3 psychiatrists, and the chair would be three medical physicians. Okay, so three physicians. Doesn't have to be psychiatrists. Okay, so 4 psychologists, 3 physicians, with the chair being a psychologist.
And being a member of the board of psychological examiners.
Okay. All right. So this group would certify and decertify, basically, but as far as disciplinary, that would fall under the board of psychologists.
Right.
Okay.
So it would be both for the certificate itself, for the certificate to prescribe, to be able to do disciplinary action. Anything other than the certificate for prescription, that discipline would be done by the psychology board.
And the right one is the discipline, Madam Chair, Robin Henderson. The discipline would be related solely to the certificate, so the revocation or suspension of privilege or imposition of additional continuing education related solely to the certificate.
All right. So are there, this is a committee bill, and we would like the committee to, we are in work session, and we would like you to consider this. I am quite impressed.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Cruz.
Madam Chair, I move LC 9 dated 1/13/10 be adopted as a committee, introduced as a committee bill.
Senator Cruz moves LC 9 dated 1/13/10 to be introduced as a committee bill. Is there any discussion or any questions for these people?
Madam Chair, I'm going to vote to move this as a committee bill because I want to move the process along, but I'm not necessarily going to be a yes vote at the end of the process. I need more information. And some back channels to be checked. It looks really good. I think you've done a good job. But I want to make sure all our I's are dotted, our T's are crossed, that everyone's satisfied. I'm still receiving information from across the country on this. I haven't had a chance to look at yet. I think you've done a great job. I especially like looking, when I look through the bill and see the requirements for education, these are essentially requirements that education, as I read it at least at this point, that a psychiatrist has to go through.
Right.
And frankly, it's more than the average primary care physician goes through, and we have the power to write these drugs.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm pretty impressed by what's been put into the bill. Having said all that, I'm going to leave a little door open for myself here and be very careful. This is a very touchy situation, and we have to be very careful with it. This is something that's a dramatic change for the people in Oregon. Of all the medications written, this is a group of drugs that has some of the most far-reaching consequences as far as how people function with these drugs. And it's really, really touchy stuff. So having said that, I'm going to vote this thing onward and upward. But I have a little caveat that will niggle in the back of my mind I want to be sure of yet. So great work. Appreciate it, Madam Chair. I appreciate your hard work on this. I think we're moving in the right direction, but I want to be careful.
Right. And the another piece that had changed was the supervision that hopefully got into the LC dated today. Supervision, and so there were some changes. And I do need to comment that there are still physicians that believe that this is the best, if we are going to have a program to certify that this is the best program, but still philosophically feel that psychologists should not be prescribing.
Right.
Yeah.
That's okay. A given. That is just a given.
All right. Yes.
Well,
Mr. McCulley,
Madam
do you want
to... John McCulley, Oregon Psychiatric Association. I just want to make sure that I'm clear sitting here at the table. Truly appreciate the work that was done here. I had the opportunity to attend almost all of the meetings, and it was a very collaborative, at times contentious process, but very well performed by everybody who was involved. And I think that in saying that, we need to give credit to Donna here for the work she did. I don't think maybe she didn't know what she was getting into, maybe she did, but she did a marvelous job in guiding this process, and I think she deserves some kudos for the work she did. Having said that, I want to make sure that my presence here doesn't indicate that we support what is going on. We may, at the end, not oppose this bill, but we still have some concerns about some specific parts of the bill related to how children would fare under this bill, and I think we need to continue to have that discussion. We have some concerns about the establishment of the formulary and the role of OMB in that formulary. And there may be a couple of others. So I am not at this point authorized by my organization to say that we either support or don't oppose the bill. We have an executive board meeting tomorrow night, at which time I will get my marching orders. And I just wanted the committee to know that, to not be under the impression, because I'm sitting here, that we are necessarily on board, even though we do truly appreciate the work that has gone into this product.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Morsett.
I would like to congratulate the Chair on the wonderful process that she has set up to deal with these types of issues that are very contentious, and because of her hard work and involvement, has, I think, came up with the most fair way of doing, arriving at a conclusion. And so, congratulations, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Yes, Senator Cruz.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going to support this at this point in time. I have reservations that are probably different from Senator Bates's reservations, but some of the things that I'd like better explained, because I do think that the amount of education required here is significant. And I would also think that, to a degree, a psychologist might be in a better position to describe mental health drugs than a general practitioner who isn't specializing in that field. So, there's an interesting dynamic here, and we need to make sure that we can satisfy as many people as possible that this is moving in the right direction. Intuitively, I don't see a problem here, but this is a big sea change and needs to be handled appropriately.
All right. With that, we have a motion. Any opposition? With that, it is moved. So moved. With that, thank you very much, committee, and thank you, Donna, so much, and for all the members of the committee. It was contentious, it was thoughtful, but it will bring a lot of credibility if we can get this thing on the floor and out the door, so to speak. All right. With that, pardon? Okay, we're still in work session for LC-10, and with that, I would like to... Who? Oh, just John Powell. Okay.
Unless there's a preemption specifically, you can do it. Aspects you could do unless they're telling you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is John Powell, representing Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon, before you today in support of LC-10. LC-10 is a legislative draft that you've heard previous testimony on, and it deals with House Bill 2116 that passed last session, enacting a 1% tax on health insurance premiums to pay for programs for children. And as you recall, Regents and other carriers had worked on a compromise on that legislation and ended up supporting the bill. As Mr. Becker from Regents says, we were too smart by one half. We applied the tax as broadly as we could, which ended up including policies written out of state. That portion of the premium that would have been protecting workers working in Oregon would be assessed. And we didn't realize the complications of doing that and the difficulty of keeping track of that premium separate from the other premium and paying a tax just on that premium. We also discovered that the insurance division, when they came up with the revenue forecast for how much tax money would be generated from House Bill 2116, they did not use data that would have included those employees. So the LC draft before you exempts those policies not written in Oregon and delivered here, and by doing so will not reduce the revenue expectations of House Bill 2116. So we not only endorse its passage, we would endorse its passage prior to February 15th, when the first assessment is actually due and payable on this tax. The tax was effective October 1st of 2009. The first payment is due February 15th. So we would appreciate if the legislature could take it up immediately.
Well, thank you.
And we did have some collaboration here with DCBS. And Teresa Miller, do you want to offer a couple of sentences before we move this out, if the committee wishes?
Madam Chair, we did work with proponents of the bill. I'm sorry. For the record, my name is Teresa Miller. I'm the administrator of the Insurance Division at the Department of Consumer and Business Services. We had had discussions with Regents and other carriers about this, and from my perspective, it really does boil down to a technical issue for your guys' consideration. And everything that Mr. Powell and Mr. Becker have represented has been consistent with my understanding. So,
all right. So there shouldn't be opposition?
I know of none.
Okay, Senator Bates, all right.
I just want to make a comment, I guess, real quickly. I was one of the four that negotiated this. It was 3 months of pure hell, frankly. And when I saw this, I thought, well, let's just pass this through and make the tax 2% and call it good. Maybe that gets people moving. But it's a glitch. We made a mistake. We missed one small piece, and then there were a lot of people looking at this. It wasn't just the four of us, and we all just missed this. And that's the complexity of the business we're in here. So I've got no problem with this. The key is, though, the question I've got here is, how do we move this bill quickly? My first thought is this might be able to be sent to Ways and Means right at the beginning of session and fire it through without having to go through two committees and get right to the floor and move it through. That's my first thought, because it's a technical fix. So, Madam Chair, I'd like to suggest that if it's possible, we'll have to check with our staff to make sure this is a legal deal to do. Mm-hmm. But I'd like to see this bill move quickly in the first days of session, because time is of an essence. And maybe move it straight to Ways and Means. My committee would be glad to take it in Ways and Means, and then get it out to the floor real quickly and get it enacted.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, that may not be a bad move. I suggest to start here in our first committee meeting. We have work session, move it, and you could probably handle it the next day.
We handle it the next day and get it out. We're on 24-hour.
Yeah, we're on 24 hours, so we may not be able to move anything until Wednesday, or Thursday, rather than Tuesday. Tuesday's our first meeting.
You could post the end of January.
What's the earliest we could post the bill?
Well, Chair and members, we go into session February 1st.
Right.
The session committee has to be formally announced on the floor.
That's true.
Before the bills get into the committee system, so we can post as soon as that happens. But from that point on, then you can fast track it.
If we meet at 10 in the morning, our committee is at 1.
So it could be the next day. If we got the agenda set, as soon as committee's formed,
we're pushing it, Rick.
The earliest we could do a hearing on a bill would be the Tuesday, because of the 24-hour notice we have to give it.
Teresa, it's up to you to make sure the governor signs it in a timely fashion.
Tuesday, yeah. Because we start Monday.
Well, we'll figure this out. We don't need to argue this right now. So we have a. I would entertain a motion.
You would? Okay.
Yes.
Okay. Madam Chair, I move LC 10, drafted 12-14-09, be introduced as a committee bill.
All right. Senator Cruz moves LC 10. Dated 12-14-09 to be introduced as a committee bill. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? So ordered. With that, okay, so we'll need to close the work session and then open an informational meeting on the complexities and culture of healthcare delivery and costs. We were trying to be very political on this, and I'd like to thank Senator Morse for bringing Dr. Larry Mullins, who's President Chief Executive Officer from Samaritan Health Services, to come talk to us about the concerns that physicians have and that hospitals have. And some enlightening thoughts.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I have to admit, as we started to discuss this subject matter, it grew larger and larger, so culture and systems kept coming to mind, but I'll try to be a bit more focused. I'll start off by introducing myself. My name is Larry Mullins. My business address is 3600 Northwest American Drive, Corvallis, Oregon. I currently serve as President and Chief Executive Officer of Samaritan Health Services. I'm a past chairman of the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems and Health Systems Council of the American Hospital Association, and have served as the regent for the American College of Healthcare Executives for the state of the Oregon. Here again, when I was looking at this last night, I was thinking there's more in the rearview mirror than there is out front ahead of me, but it has created an opportunity for me to have some pretty good opportunities to see our systems work. For clarification, I do not appear before you representing any of those organizations or their views, but rather as a private citizen and a healthcare professional. It's a privilege to be with you today and try to comment on a highly complex subject, the culture and cost of healthcare delivery. But I sincerely believe that if we're going to talk about how to reform the system and get the changes in place that we need, we have to talk about it somewhat collectively, not individually. For clarification purposes, since you were kind enough to use my official title of doctor, I probably should clarify my doctorate is neither in law nor medicine, so I won't be giving you legal opinions or medical opinions. But what I will try to do is give you a perspective from having studied healthcare administration and observed how it works or it sometimes doesn't work so well over the course of about four decades, so an individual view of the field that we're in. By way of background, to give you some perspective on where I might be commenting from, Samaritan Health Services is an integrated delivery network, essentially a group of five hospitals geographically dispersed over three county areas that employs about 5,000 employees within our organization, also employs in excess of about 300 physicians, and are participating in the delivery of health care to a complete and diverse population of about 250,000 people. Our operations go from critical access size operations over on the coast and in the Mid-Valley up to and including a regional medical center. One of our more recent developments, which really has created an opportunity for me to learn more about the education and training of our workforce, has been a partnership with Western University of Health Sciences in building the first new medical school in Oregon in over 100 years. And we started construction on that just in the past several months, and we anticipate sitting in our first class in June of 2011. So we're quite excited about that possibility. When I was first approached about speaking about this subject, essentially we were focusing a little bit more on defensive medicine and whether the lack of credible tort reform within the state of Oregon would impact the way healthcare was delivered and the cost of healthcare in of itself. But as I talked to a number of people, some on the committee and outside of the committee, about the subject, we concluded that we needed not only to talk about defensive medicine, but about the cultures and complexities of healthcare delivery and how it works. That conclusion was supported by an event I attended this past weekend at a town hall meeting held by Senator Wyden. And in the course of almost 2 hours of questioning and answering with the general public, the people who spoke of which were drawn by lottery, if you will, they spent almost 2 hours exclusively on healthcare. I think in the course of the dialogue, there were maybe three questions that related to the economy, to national security, and to one other subject matter. But clearly, this is on people's minds in a way that I think is sometimes a little bit hard to fully appreciate and understand. So it's a complex subject that a lot of people at the federal, state, local, and regional level are trying to seek resolutions to, and I thought maybe to frame this discussion a little bit more understandably, I try to speak to it with five or six key areas in looking at it. The irony is that I put this together last night. I looked at the acronym that it created with the starting words of the five key areas, and came up with Rambo, and I thought, am I really going to have to come before this committee and say I want to talk to you about Rambo? But the more I thought about it, I thought much like that character, what actions are going to be necessary are going to be somewhat unconventional in nature in terms of really reforming healthcare delivery if we're going to achieve that mission. And it's going to take a passion and a zeal much like that character might show us. So I left the Rambo intact. So the first area I'd like to speak to you on for a moment is the reimbursement model. And it's, again, it's a subject matter that, depending on who you're talking to, they're going to have strong views and opinions on what is. But if you try to step back and look at it, I think we could probably get consensus that it's a reimbursement model that's primarily based on production, not necessarily based on outcomes. And I don't think we should be surprised that when you have a model like that, both for the individual practitioners or the institutions or others as well, that you're going to see increases in costs and volumes, because that's indeed what's driving it, is the incentive factor of production, if you will. And yet at the same time, and I know this from having, as I mentioned earlier, employing a large number of physicians, you need a production-based model to ensure that activity is kept intact and that you do get the work product that you're looking for. Now, in that regard, I've been asked to speak to a couple of specific questions. One was the one about, well, do doctors and hospitals unnecessarily order tests in order to achieve some of the revenue goals and projections that they have? And I can understand where the question would come from, and I can think of isolated incidents where that may be indeed the case. But I would have to represent to you overall that that's not the case at all. I think in most instances, physicians that are practicing, particularly doctors that are practicing in a hospital setting, do not have a financial interest in the hospital. So there really is no incentive or motivating factor for them to order one type of test over another type of test. And in fact, in most cases, hospitals and doctors, I think, do a pretty good job of being a check and balance with each other through the peer review process, the medical staff review committees, and such about utilization of tests and so forth. Now, the exceptions that might occur to that premise is if indeed there is a financial interest, either in the equipment or the technology or the operation itself. And it's fair to say that there could be improvement in the rules and regulations that are in place to monitor this. And I'm hopeful that both at the state and federal level, that better legislation would be developed to monitor and in some cases prohibit and actually address that issue more so. Now, what also might be affecting utilization even more than financial incentives, because I think we can watch that pretty closely, are what I would describe as non-tangible items. And that would be the second part of the issue that I would present to you, which is attitudes and expectations. And this really came out of the conversation I had with staff here and others about what really does drive doctors to practice the way they practice, hospitals to do what they do, and patients and others to respond in the way they do. And I think a number of things go into it. Certainly, there's a lot of studies that speak to this issue. But essentially, I think patients really do expect their doctor to figure out what's wrong and to fix it. So there's an expectation going in that they're going to an expert on a subject matter. They can take care of what's wrong. It puts a tremendous burden on the doctor to try to come up with the answer, and the right answer especially. And as such, some are more predisposed than others, perhaps, to use the medical armada that we have to try to seek the answer to that question. In fact, a term that I've often heard in the educational setting is that when you go through medical schools, you go through nursing schools and other areas, they teach you to look for the most common thing, because statistically, that's what you're likely to see. And in some cases, though, you're out looking for that zebra. You're looking for that rare exception to the rule to say, what's going on with this patient and why is it happening? And I think for a number of physicians, they really are challenged to find the answer for their patients. Now, the other reason that you could see increased utilization as well is the patients and the families themselves. Very seldom have I ever heard, either anecdotally or through any kind of a reporting process, that patients or families are coming in saying, well, don't do these things, with exceptions. Sometimes at the end-of-life type discussions, you would have that kind of conversation. But essentially, I think the general rule of thumb is that families will indeed expect that the doctor will do all they can do to find out what the cause is of the problem and all they can do to intervene and to fix the problem. And then perhaps the other attitude and expectation factor that plays in is that physicians, nurses, and others in the field are really caring professionals. Now, again, we have our exceptions to the rule like any other profession does. But I think if you look at the people that do what they do, they want to excel at caring for their patients, And sometimes our evaluation of global issues, the cost and the rationales behind them, is very different than what they're encountering in that individual exchange between a patient, a physician, or other provider. Now, other things come into play, and this is perhaps getting to the subject matter that I know you wanted to speak about, which is what are the other things that impact utilization, and one of them, I think it can be fairly said, is the medical malpractice syndrome. And I literally do kind of refer to it as a syndrome because it's caused a series of other things to happen whenever you think about the subject matter. And in this instance, I think one of the things that happens is that many physicians, many providers, many institutions have either experienced or heard about significant negative consequences to other physicians or other hospitals if they make a medical mistake or miss a diagnosis. Now, anecdotally, if you hang around the medical staff lounges and other areas long enough, you'll oftentimes hear a statement such as, I really didn't think they needed a certain test, but. And then the but can go into many different directions as to the rationale behind it. But one of the major factors behind the but is they didn't want to miss something. Certainly, first and foremost, for the benefit of the patient, they don't want to miss something. Maybe for their professional reputation, but also for their own risk position, that they don't want to be subject to having either criticism or economic hardships. Now, what supports what I just kind of anecdotally told you, and I had a couple of articles that were already passed out, that you can read at your leisure, and I did a pretty good literature search in preparation of this, and I can tell you, you can find articles both ways about this whole subject matter. But I thought the two that I gave you from the American Journal of Public Health, which is kind of a interested third party, if you will. They don't practice medicine. They're not hospitals, but they're looking at the status of public health. And another one on diagnostic utilization by the American Radiology groups were kind of insightful. And as you go through those, I'll try to give you a quick summary here. Some of the studies suggest that defensive medicine practices add about 3% of cost to overall health care delivery on an annualized type basis. Now, some have also argued, and I think there's some data to support this, that it could represent as much as 5 to 9% of the annual U.S. health care budget. Now, in 2007 or 2008, I can't remember the citation year on that, it was fairly clear that that number was $2 trillion plus. And if you just allowed for escalation and inflation over the course of the last several years, I think it would be 2 trillion point something something, maybe even pushing into the 3 itself. So those two articles that you have from the Academy of Radiology and our Academic Radiology and the American Journal of Public Health, I might commend to you to read at your leisure, get some perspective on it. But I'll also suggest to you, if you really do the literature search, you're going to find counter arguments to the question as well. Perhaps a better way to look at that specific question, and one that kind of steps back from the political debate and the interest debates, if you will, I think is to ask the question that if you're talking about things like cap limitations, if you're talking about issues about tort reform and so forth, to ask the question, why is that basically the government model of operation? If you look at health districts, if you look at taxable districts, if you look at fire districts, if you look at school districts and everything else, I think repeatedly there's been very clear commentary made as to why they need to have caps and limitations. And since we are indeed starting to take a look at health almost as a commodity of the public good, if you will, I think you have to ask that question in that context as well. Is that if you have other tools available to you to help address and restrain the cost, why aren't we doing it? Now, another thing that you might want to look at is to take a look at a book that was written some years back called To Err is Human. And what that book essentially was about was the practice of healthcare and medicine and the need for greater transparency in it. In fact, some would reference that writing is one of the driving forces behind the era that we're in now about self-reporting and monitoring and so forth and about quality and transparency. And for the largest part, I think that's a good thing. Now, you'll get debates depending on whom you're talking to about the accuracy of the data and does it really mean anything and is it relevant to what you're measuring. But I think most would say it probably does have relevancy to the discussion. But I've also heard some say that it should also have a side title. And the side title could be To Err is Human. and also costly. And it could be costly from an emotional perspective, because anybody that's been through one of these processes will tell you it is an event. It's an event that changes your life, it changes the institution, it changes the culture, and it changes your future behaviors and actions. Sometimes good, sometimes maybe not so good. It's costly in terms of the physical impact on the patient, certainly first and foremost, but also those that provide care. Because one of the other things I've had the privilege of observing of healthcare providers over the years, doctors, nurses, technicians, orderlies, and others, is they really do care. And when things don't go right, they probably suffer as much of an emotional, physical hit as any other party out there. And then last but not least, and certainly something we can measure economically, it has an impact. And I can tell you from a firsthand basis, when you receive that large number about a suit and you try to get some relevancy to it, you can appreciate why it's done the way it is, but it does change how you do what you do. And unfortunately, I think it distracts sometimes from focusing on the quality and the improvement initiatives to more of the defensive practices and how do we mitigate and limit what the economic damages might be. So that led to the fourth area. I'm getting through this. I'll be done here in just a couple of minutes. And that's benefit design and workforce development. And I think the comment I would start off with in this regard is that once promised, any of us, once we promise something, it's very, very hard to take it back. And that doesn't matter if you're in the private sector or in the public sector. Once you tell your employees, once you tell your workforce that here's what you got, trying to pull it back is twice as difficult as awarding in the first place. But in essence, in a large part, that's what our society has done with healthcare. We have made a number of promises through multiple mechanisms at different levels, public and private sector as well. And we established a standard that all parties are eligible to a certain level of care. In fact, we established that standard both at a legal, ethical, and expectations outcome perspective as well. What we didn't do along the way, quite candidly, we didn't fund it. What we did was we said that this is the expectation we have, and therefore we left it in large part to the industry at times to figure out, well, how do we get the funds to achieve the outcome that everybody wants to get? That's where you hear about cost shifting. That's where you hear about different types of activities to cover those programs, those products, those services where they're not compensated, where in some cases there's no compensation. I started to give you kind of a balance sheet perspective on that, and I thought, no, I'm not going to go there. I'd be happy to give it to you, but I'll give you a quick reference point. If we were to generate about $900 million of charges, that's probably what a system like ours would see in the course of a year. We would probably be fortunate if we saw $600 million. Our two-thirds of that actually get to the net revenue line from which we then start to operate. So you can kind of get a sense if we're saying one-third of everything we're charging for is being reallocated and covered by some other types of activities, or it doesn't really count at all. We also need to remember that with new technologies and better medical care, life expectancy more likely than not will extend. That's what it's done for the last century. There's no reason not to believe it will go further. With some of the technologies and innovations out of there, particularly in the genetic realm and biosciences realm, it's just really is startling and exceptionally good that we're going to be able to do things for patients that we haven't been able to do in the past, including the reproduction of certain organs and other activities that are really just very, very emerging right now. Now, when we do that, we're going to have an impact on the cost of that delivery to others. So I think we need to be real thoughtful as we go forward what those expectations are, what the benefit design looks like that we're promising to everybody, and how we intend to pay for that, private sector and public sector alike. Now, along the way, what are we doing right now? We're covering a lot more lives. Now, I won't get into debate about the federal health care reform, what it did or didn't do, but most would argue it was more of a health insurance type of reform activity than an actual substantive organic or structural change to the delivery system itself. But I think what it has told us is we're going to need a lot more of everything to care for people that previously we weren't caring for in the primary sense. Now, I think it's fair to say we cared for them in the acute sense. When they got to the ERs, when they got to those areas, we got good medical care to them. But now with another 20, 30, 40 million covered lives, we better figure out the primary care side of this model, the medical home, if you will, and how we're going to provide care to those patients. We also need to think of the connectivity. and how the workforce connects for the distribution of information, continuity of care, and so forth. So I would like to mention to you that the workforce is going to have to be continued to be invested in to meet not just the increasing demands of the baby boomers. I mean, we've been talking about that for years to come, but also for the increased provision of care on the primary care side of delivery to an increased population that's occurring as we speak through additional coverage efforts. And I applaud those coverage efforts. I think anybody in healthcare would say we'd rather see our patients covered and provide some mechanism for funding of them. So if we insure or cover millions more, we need to make sure that the educational system, the graduate medical education, funding for doctors, for training of them in postgraduate settings as well for other healthcare professionals matches up to that. The next big gap we're going to have is a delivery capability gap that we don't have enough providers to care for the patients out there. Now, one of the last areas, and I think I'm down to the O on ramble now, is the outcomes rewarded. And I think it's really important that we try to produce a model that provides incentives to the public to practice healthier lifestyles and also candidly places a burden if they choose not to. And I'm not talking about instances that the patient or the individual has no choice over. If they got a certain genetic predisposition to a certain type of medical condition, I think we empathize with that. We do the best that we can to help them. But it's clear in certain areas that there's certain lifestyle activities that if people cease and desist from are going to enhance their health status and lower their health care costs to society overall. And there's also instances where we know that if we can modify certain lifestyle activities, we will get healthier outcomes and lower costs. And in the private sector and others as well have started to move into this arena, but it's one that's obviously going to be debated probably in the court system in terms of a rights issue and can we do this or can we not do that. But it's one when we talk about reforming of health care and what's affecting it is one that we really need to have right at the top of the list. Because if we don't provide incentives to keep them healthier, people will do what they naturally want to do. So we got to put some boundaries around it. We can't just have provision of care without qualified provision of care dependent upon what you do. And those changes, along with significant restructuring of the healthcare system, and I'm talking about hospitals now, I'm talking about healthcare delivery models overall, are things that are going to be generational. We're not. I don't think it's physically possible without imploding the whole system to flip a switch, and suddenly tomorrow we shift from this model to that kind of model. And so in that regard, they need to be financially supported while the change occurs. Because for the better part of a century now, we have built a healthcare system, and I'm talking about nationally across the board, that does certain things very differently than what most would propose the future healthcare model needs to look like. And so in part that was driven by the economic model, the reimbursement model, that set that up. So if we change the reimbursement model, you know there's going to be changes in the delivery model, and we need to be aware of that. So in summary, we have many challenges to changing a highly complex, socially and economically critical healthcare system. And I mentioned economically critical, not just in the sense of the cost of healthcare, but recognizing that healthcare in of itself is an economic entity that provides jobs, delivers not just care to the community, but economic well-being to the communities as well. And much like any other major industry, whether it's automotive or information technologies or whatever, we need to be very thoughtful about how quickly we change things. Now, having said all of that, I'm going to leave you with two quotes. One is perhaps a little bit higher elevated than the other, but I think they have the same message. Kennedy said, there are risk and cost to action, but far less than the long-range risk and cost to inaction. So I think we all know that. We got to make the changes, get them going through. But the other quote I thought was rather telling kind of goes back to the Rambo analogy, and it's one from Sylvester Stallone. And Sylvester Stallone said, you got to do what you got to do. Thank you,
I want to thank you very much for coming. You know, this committee is very supportive in wanting to look at changes, and I know that the Oregon Medical Association has some ideas, and I think other association has ideas, and usually this topic is discussed in the Judiciary Committee and not in the Health Committee. And so when Senator Morse came to me to say that you could give a perspective that would be very valuable, you were correct. So thank you, Senator Morse, for inviting you, and thank you for giving the time. Are there comments?
Yes. Just one comment to thank you, Dr. Mullins, for coming. We are very blessed in our region, my Senate district, and beyond, to have his leadership, and I'm glad that he was able to share with us today. So thank you, Larry.
Oh, thank you, Senator.
Okay. Anyone else? Thank you. Yes. Thank you very much, and I know that this conversation is going to be held in other committees, and if we need to bring you back, hopefully you'll be able to do that.
Madam Chair, one comment. As a Democratic senator, I support caps on malpractice. Giving it a lot of thought, we're one of the few states that we don't have caps. We have a supplement that goes to OBGYNs and so on in Oregon that's going to run out. We're going to lose physicians in the state unless we come up with some sort of a cap. And many other states have figured it out. We haven't yet, and I'm hoping that we will do that. So I just wanted to that I do support that, and I appreciate this particular piece that you've distributed, because there's a lot of really, really good information in this. So thank you.
We're going to call it the Bill Moore Set Bill.
Hey, that's okay.
Thank you very much. All right. With that, I'd like to move on to what we had scheduled next with Sean Miller, Teresa Miller, and Lisa Trussell. If you'd like to come forward, this is modifying the 95% retention rate requirement for association health plans. This is going to be in LC 38. It is in LC 38, so this will be a bill, and we feel it's extremely important for the committee to have a heads up, because hopefully there won't be much opposition, if any, and we can move it through quickly.
Yes. Right. Madam Chair, members of the committee, if it's okay, I'll just start.
Now, who are you again?
My name's Teresa.
And who do you represent?
I am the administrator of the insurance division at the Department of Consumer Business.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you. Just for the record. And I appreciate the opportunity to be here and talk about the legislation that you all will see in February. Before I get into the specifics of that issue, I just wanted to start off with a brief little story, I guess, about the purpose behind insurance rate regulation. In the area of group health insurance, we generally look for ways to group people into large enough pools so that we spread the costs of health care as broadly as possible. And the idea is that insurance is then available and affordable to more employees and more employers. And to accomplish this, Oregon's rate regulation requires insurers to treat all small businesses, which are businesses with 2 to 50 employees, as a single pool for purposes of setting rates. This means if a small employer has an employee who gets sick, their rates aren't going to go up, or if they have high health care costs, they have one employee with high health care costs, they're not going to experience a huge increase in their rates. Rates can vary in the small group market only based on certain factors, and we limit the range in rates so that the highest rate charged an employer is no greater than 3 times the lowest rate charged another employer. We call that a 3-to-1 rate band. So in 2007, the legislature passed House Bill 3321, which was intended to resolve issues about how these small group rating laws that I just talked about, how they apply to association health plans. The bill exempts association health plans from these small group rating laws if the association health plan meets certain requirements that are aimed at preventing what we call cherry picking. In other words, taking the healthy groups out of the small group market, giving them cheaper rates, leaving those employers who are left in the small group market with higher rates because they would have a smaller pool. So the law exempts association health plans from small group rating laws if they meet certain requirements enumerated in House Bill 3321. One of those requirements is that the association health plan maintain what we call a 95% retention rate, which means the health plan cannot lose more than 5% of its members. Since the law passed, the nation has, of course, suffered the worst economic downturn in several decades, and we've heard concerns from a few associations that they're having trouble meeting the 95% retention rate. So over the last several months, I've worked with Sean Miller and Lisa Trussell to come up with legislation for the February session that will allow insurers to request a waiver from the 95% retention requirement. If the legislation passes, the department would establish standards through rulemaking to review waiver requests that will ensure that the protections in the current law aimed at preventing cherry picking are not undermined. So with that, Madam Chair, I appreciate the committee's interest in this topic, and I will be happy to let Sean and Lisa talk to you and answer any questions that you have.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Sean Miller. I'm here today on behalf of the Associated Builders and Contractors and the Independent Electrical Contractors in support of the LC draft that you'll see. And actually, I just heard, Senator, from your office that I believe it's going to be Senate Bill 1003, I think.
Oh, really?
I think so.
Okay.
But don't hold me to that. So, in any event, I wanted to just... No, it wouldn't be that high.
No, it wouldn't.
No, we probably start at 1,000. We probably started at 1,000. Yeah.
I'm confused. So.
Yeah.
In any event,
I'm
confused you right off the bat, Madam Chair. But in any event, I just wanted to describe just the scope of the problem since the bill passed in 2007. And as Teresa indicated, when the economic the climate in Oregon and the bottom dropping out of the economy and the effects on business, it's forced them to actually do a lot more shopping for anything that they spend. And obviously, healthcare is one of the largest expenses that businesses pay for. And so, what we found was a lot of people moving from plan to plan, obviously trying to get the best deal they can. Now, in associations, there's a lot of folks that have a lot of pride in the association that they belong to. That's why associations offer these health care plans to their employers. What we found, especially in the construction industry, and again, this falls in all lines of business because it was not just construction that we felt we're going to have issues with the 95% retention rate, but I can tell you they were hit probably one of the hardest in this economy. And we found that in a two-year period, very difficult to hit that 95%. We were lower and in some respects quite a bit lower. But when you look at it, it was not because of cherry picking. Remember, in 2007, that 95% retention rate was put in place as kind of an indicator to whether you are, trying to seek out the best risk people and then cannibalize the C-high market, the small group market. And so we then approached the division knowing that, like the law says, if you hit that two-year period, you lose your plan. And you don't know after the second year of hitting it until the insurance company tells the association that, no, you didn't hit that mark, and then you got to quickly tell your employers, go find other insurance or you're going to be put into the C-high market automatically. Well, that issue was facing the two organizations that I represent. And just to give you a scope of the problem, when we found out that this could be an issue, we kind of re-rated or looked at the rates of transferring all that business into the C-high market. And I'll give you some examples. There was a roofing company, Astoria, that would have experienced a 63% increase. A fastening company in St. Helens, 16%. Plumbing company in Central Point, 37% increase. A truss company in Medford, 25%. Electrical contractor in Central Point, 20%. Heating and cooling contractor in Roseburg, 26%. And the list goes on and on. And again, it was, for us, it was going to be a major disruption in the marketplace from an association standpoint, having to quickly tell these employers that you got to find something else, or this is what you're stuck with. As talking to our members, I think the bottom line was, we can't afford this. I mean, we're on part-time making ends meet right now, which ultimately leads to more uninsured people in the state if they can't afford it, because that means their employees are not going to have health care. So that's just the issue, the scope of the issue that we were dealing with. And to have this two-year, you know, you lose your program if you just can't meet 95% retention rate. And so then what we did is we ran the loss ratio of the folks who may have left and the folks that stayed with the association. We found out that we had some folks with 700% loss ratios that stayed with the association, and people with 30% loss ratios that left. So we're getting counted against our retention rate with people that left the association. And so if we were doing cherry picking, we were doing a really bad job of cherry picking. Yeah, so what we found is when we met with the insurance division, and I give Teresa a lot of credit, because, you know, obviously looking at this determined that no, this really goes against the intent. It was harming the market, you know, the opposite direction. So we need to find a way to, at least when they look at the numbers that we're looking at, clearly we're not cherry picking, because we don't do that. Associations don't do that. We try to include anybody and everybody we can. That something needed to be done. And that's the bill that you're going to see before you is going to give the division the ability to have a variance, if you will, to look at it. If you're falling below the 95%, they can look at these factors, such as the loss ratio, and look at what the insurance company provides and say, well, of course these shouldn't be counted against your retention rate, because it doesn't make sense that you're involved in cherry picking. So this is just one of the examples that I think will come out in the rulemaking. There's probably others, because there's been several other kinds of examples. We didn't feel, just in the time frame and to get this done, that to put all this in statute would have been probably difficult. That's why we all agreed, I think, to regroup and Teresa's shop and write this by rule on what that means. But in any event, we believe this will at least solve our problem of disrupting the market and keeping it things the way they are, but also give the insurance division the ability to still regulate people that are going to cherry pick. I guess the original issue that brought this was an out-of-state association that came in and tried to cherry pick all the good risk. So everybody else was left to the Oregon Sea High market. My understanding is you all in the healthcare committees over the last few sessions have made tighten that down a lot to where that really doesn't exist anymore. So I can understand why it was originally put in place, but we didn't want to affect associations. I do want to give credit to some other associations I know that were involved at the table. I know the Auto Trades Associations, Associated Oregon Industries, and the Associated General Contractors. I know Mr. Rakowitz, Mr. Hagedorn are also here. They were also involved in this process. But again, we hope that this is a bill that you will see. I know it's been sponsored by members of this committee, and we hope to move it fairly quickly. So I appreciate the time, and happy to answer any questions.
Lisa, do you want to say anything? Okay. All right, questions? The bill will be before us next week, or no, 2 weeks, I guess.
3 weeks.
3 weeks?
Whenever,
yes.
Soon.
Okay,
yeah.
Soon.
Committee near you.
All right.
A couple comments real quick.
Yes.
I understand your issues in this particular narrow look at part of the insurance code, but I think we also have to be aware this is just a narrow part of the code. What's driving these premiums up is not just what you've talked about, but the escalating cost of health care, number of people dropping out of pools because they can't afford the premiums, either because of the recession or without the recession that would be going on. It was going on before the recession hit. Mm-hmm. This is the beginning of a discussion. We have some big federal changes probably coming, maybe not, who knows, but likely coming, which will affect this insurance market, especially small groups, not self-insured groups, small groups. And I think that in February we'll have a little bit of a discussion about that, but nothing significant other than, I'm guessing, your bill. Mm-hmm. But be ready for January, because I think at that time we're going to be looking at the small group market Every part of the market other than self-insureds are going to be dramatically affected, I think, by what's happening at the federal level. And I expect that the health authority will be helping us walk through some really difficult and strange issues, okay? And maybe we'll start lining up incentives the right way for insurers. That we're talking about tobacco cessation, wellness programs, and not so much worried about age and gender when we rate people or past history, because we want large pools with the right incentives in them to help hold down health care costs. So be ready for that discussion. This is a quick fix for a significant issue, but really in the overall picture, a minor issue. Things are going to change pretty rapidly, I think, in the next 8 or 9 months. I see heads nodding up and down, so I assume you agree with me. Right, Teresa?
Absolutely.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Any other comments? All right. Thank you very, very much. With that, we'll move on to progress toward development of uniform standards for health insurers licensed in Oregon, House Bill 2009. And I'd like to ask Dr. Janine Smith and Lynn Marie Kreider. Okay.
Yeah, I know.
Senator Mona Sanderson, members of the committee. For the record, Janine Smith, the administrator of the Office of Health Policy and Research, and I wanted to introduce one of our new policy analysts that's been with us since September and is the person working in this area, so I brought her along in case there are tough questions for me. But nice to see you all again, and here we are starting to do some of the things that you helped pass in House Bill 2009. We were directed to develop some, via a stakeholder process, some standards around how to improve how administrative transactions are done in the healthcare world. And what you have before you as handouts is the work plan, as we just discussed yesterday with the Health Policy Board, and a sort of a two-page matrix that helps to outline sort of our initial work, which has been predominantly around a sort of an environmental scan of what is going on, as that we wanted to ensure that there has been a lot of efforts, certainly by leaders in the industry over the last couple of years, to see where they were in their work, and also what was going on in other states. The goal is to do this work is that it ultimately would hopefully, ideally, would lower costs. Healthcare transaction costs are a large component of our healthcare costs, and so that we can, as well as improving efficiency and better care coordination. And it's the aim is that reasonable per capita costs could be reduced. There were some estimates up to about 13% of the healthcare dollars spent on healthcare transactions. So we have met with numerous stakeholders more on an individual basis at this point, just to try to get a good feel of what is going on. Lynn Marie has actually spent time in various clinics, offices with their staff, just to better understand. She's worked with the hospital, some staffs to understand some of the sort of nuances as you go into this area. To, you know, I know Dr. Bates and I are well familiar with some of this, but it's I think good to have others look at this and really see how convoluted and complex sometimes getting a bill paid is as after the doc has actually seen the patient. We've also spent a lot of time working with the Health Leadership Task Force. This is the group of a combination of efforts from the major plans in the state with several of the healthcare providers that's been staffed by Denise Hansel and John Lee through the Oregon Business Council. And they've had extensive work groups on the various of the same areas and are working towards some uniform processes. Primarily, they're currently very focused on physician credentialing. There's a lot of rework that each plan has to do when they credential a physician, and how could they do that better, perhaps more uniformly. They also are trying to figure out, and just I think got conclusion based on my conversation with Denise yesterday, of agreement to one portal that a clinic could go into and then go out to the various plans, rather than having to remember 7 to 10 different passwords and entries. And it's the first step through a doorway of improved efficiency on how to get eligibility information about a client that has come into the office for care and get what is needed to get the bill paid and coordinated or pre-approved for procedures. They had subcommittee had just presented to their task force, I think it was last week, and we're going to meet again this week to talk a little further about where that is landing. We've also spent some time talking to some other states that are doing this. Minnesota, Utah, and Washington State have done a variety of things, and those are on your matrix, but we're looking to see kind of which of those makes sense, and really what's the role of the state in this versus what's the role of the industry itself that's starting to really look at this as well. So and then on top of that, we're also following the federal health reform legislation, of which there are some very specific things in there, and so how that all plays out, which hopefully we'll know in the next few weeks, will also sort of dictate what the state would need to do or might want to do on top of that. So it's a lot of moving parts here. So we are proceeding with getting a more formalized stakeholder input process to partner with those that are already doing this in the state, detailed survey information to help us guide that, and more spending some time with the insurers as well to understand what's feasible, and we'd be able to return back to you and the policy board with some very specific recommendations, which they actually then go also on to DCBS to actually help implement them. So with that, that's sort of a high-level overview, because I know you guys are on short time.
That's wonderful. Comments? I'm very interested in what's happening with the health authority now, and all of, and so it's nice for you to come and let us know what's happening here. I keep having questions asked, well, what's happening over there? And I said, well, things are happening, but we will probably wait till 2011 to get a really full report, because you're just starting so many new areas of topics to be covered and researched and analyzed.
Yes, Senator Mona Sanderson, committee. We presented at least four or five work plans yesterday. There's five or six charters of the various committees of the board. Also, that their work is underway. We've got our primary care patient-centered home standards committee just starting to wrap up their work. So there's a lot of things moving. The Pulse Registry is up, and so there's a variety of things that are kick-starting off. So we can give you a more of an overview whenever or individually, however you would like.
Well, when you have information that you feel is important too, don't hesitate to wait for us to ask you. You can just let Rick know, and we'll see what we can do. Yeah. Yes.
Questions?
Yes.
A couple just quick questions. I just want to kind of get the vision here on a couple of issues. You have in here a uniform insurance card, and it sounds very simple, but, you know, it isn't. And you may remember from your days when you were practicing, I think you still are, you know, we were running about 30% administrative overhead in our practice of medicine in the United States. Most countries do it 10, 11, 12%. I mean, if you just captured that loss, we would start balancing the books here already. So we use up huge amounts of money in the overhead for administrative costs, primarily in the billing. In most doctors' offices, the biggest expense for them, and especially in primary care, is the billing expense. It's just outrageous, and it's Byzantine. So is your vision for a card one that you walk in the doctor's office or the clinic or the hospital, and electronically the patient can tell what their copay is, what their deductible is, and where they are in their deductible, is it verifiable that in fact is their insurance, all those things that we all think everyone knows but you don't really know, and what the prescription benefit is or isn't, and have you had a conversation about maybe standardizing some of those a little more than they are now? I mean, policies are sold on these bases as many times, so you don't want to go too far that way, but you want to kind of start moving that in the right direction. This is, my question is, do you have that vision, or is it just we want all the cards to look the same?
Senator Bates and Chair Mona Sanderson, I think the thinking overall, and again, the Health Leadership Task Force has spent more time in the weeds of this than we have so far, but I think the essence is, how do you streamline the processes? And so is the card the way to do it, or is it that you go in one port and everything know, something triggers you to have all that information come up very swiftly and smoothly for your front office staff or your back office staff without having to go in 17 places to get 17 different separate pieces of information. So is it best captured on a card that's like a smart card kind of thing, or is it best captured by you show your card, they put in a code, go in this one port, and all that information is there? I think the actually how you implement it is, there's probably pros and cons on both of those that I couldn't really speak to today, but I think the essence of it is there's a lot of wasted effort to try to get that information, so how can we decrease that effort and make it decrease the administrative burden of your office as well as on the plan side, so the overall cost on both sides could be reduced and applied to different things.
That's how you get there. So the vision is to get there.
The vision is to get
that's,
there.
That's what I'm trying to get
right.
to here.
Right.
And along the same lines, pre-authorization for services,
right.
imaging,
right.
Denials that come in after the procedure or prescription has been written. I assume that's you're looking for
all those things have
time
been
of service table. Information so a decision can be made. Correct?
Right.
Those of you who haven't been there, it is not unusual to ask mm-hmm. for, say, a CT scan on a patient, disregarding the previous conversation. Let's say this one's is appropriate, needs to be done. One insurance company will tell you, fine, go do it. We don't require pre-authorization. The next one doesn't. You don't know which one is which. You get on the phone, and your nurse will sit on that phone 20, 30, 45 minutes, maybe an hour or two. We just leave it on, listen to the music before we get through to somebody. And quite often you get clicked off after a while, or quite often you'll find that when they do answer your call, you've kind of forgotten what you were there for because it's been like an hour seeing other people. And this is the burden we deal with every day, and everyone does. And it's expensive for both sides, not just for the doctor or the patient. It's expensive for the insurance company, too. So I assume the vision is still there for resolving some of these issues.
Senator Bates, Chair Bonus Anderson, definitely the essence is the outcome. It's not, you know, we can have whatever the best process to get to the optimal outcome in the end is to streamline the efficiency and lower the costs so they can be better used elsewhere.
And I hope some uniformity in what is allowed by various insurers is important too. This having this wild, wild west approach to it, it drives costs through the roof.
Mm-hmm.
And ultimately everything gets okayed. This takes longer than some of those. And on the pulse form registry, it's going very well except for one part of the state.
Yours?
Naturally.
Oh, no.
So we're working on it down there. I got a call last week, you know.
Yeah.
Senator Bates, everyone's doing well on this. We've got over 5,000 lives except for Southern Oregon. Oh, thanks. So I'll get busy with you on it, okay.
Great. Anything else? All right. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
All right.
We call Senator Rosenbaum.
Okay. Senator Rosenbaum, we can't find her at this point in time, but I would like the next topic we're going to discuss is an update on the Oregon Breast and Cervical Cancer Program. But we'll call Dr. Catherine Bradley and Gene Phillips up if you would so honor us with your presentation.
I'll be right back.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Kathy Bradley. I'm the administrator for the Office of Family Health in the Public Health Division. And with me today...
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Jean Phillips, and I'm the Deputy Administrator for the Division of Medical Assistance Programs.
Chairman Sanderson and committee, we are here today to provide a brief update actually on some of the financial challenges that the breast and cervical cancer program on the treatment side is facing. And because we presented on this last year and there was some confusion about the difference between the treatment side and the screening side, we're both here. But the focus of what we'll be talking today is screening. As a brief overview, the breast and cervical cancer program is for low-income, uninsured, and medically underserved women so that they have access to early detection of breast and cervical cancer treatment and screening. Oregon is among the top five states in the nation for high ranking of the incidence of breast cancer. It's estimated that approximately 47 women a week are diagnosed with breast cancer, and 10 will die. from the disease in Oregon. And in terms of cervical cancer, it is the 16th most common cancer among women, and it is the fourth most common cancer amongst Latina women in Oregon. Currently, in Oregon, we are estimated to need about 57,000 women to be screened on an annual basis. The funding that we have allows for about 6,000. So there's a fairly significant discrepancy from screening in terms of what the need is and what we're able to achieve. The crux of this is that the screening occurs as a result of funding that we receive from CDC, and their grant requires a dollar of local funds for every $3 of the federal funds. In the past, these funds have come from Susan G. Komen for the Cure and also from the American Cancer Society. We do not have any general fund that currently supports this. In this last year, the American Cancer Society has had to reduce their funding, and as of August 2010, they will no longer have any funding available for the program. What they are experiencing is very similar to other volunteer groups and funding groups with the current economy in terms of their donation and their cash flow has been reduced. And this has placed the screening side of the program at risk for being able to match the 1-to-3 match, as well as to be able to address then the needs just for the 6,000 women a year that we're trying to meet. The handout that you have in front of you, on one side of it, you actually have a grid. The intent of that grid is to give a little bit of clarity as to what is the screening side of the program, which is on the left-hand side of the grid. On the right-hand side of the grid is the treatment side, and Ms. Phillips is here to address that if there are some questions. But again, I direct your attention to the left-hand side of the grid, which is about screening. It's a CDC-funded program. Our annual award is a little over $2 million. The required match is a little under 800,000, and that enables us to screen about 6,000 women a year. If you turn your page over, I would direct you to the middle of the page where it talks about program funding requires match funds. What we've tried to lay out for you there is to lay out what the funding gap will be. In the first grant year, it was 08-09, and that was what we were doing previously. What you'll see is that we got a funding award for a little over $2 million, a match of a little under $800,000, and with our funds, it actually brought us to what the need was, around $880,000 for matched funding. This year, we have a shortfall of about $180,000. We have, with the decrease in funding, we've been able to match most of that, we think, with in-kind services, but they are fairly limited and tenuous and will not continue through the summer of 2010. And so in the bottom of the box, what you see is starting in July of 2010 through 2011, assuming a similar award from CDC of about $23,000, the match would be a little under $800,000, and we will have a shortfall of about $220,000. At the bottom of the page, what you'll see is that under the first bullet, for every $100,000 in match funds lost, we lose about $300,000 in federal funds, which results in about 1,600 fewer women being able to be screened. So we were trying to just highlight for the committee the precariousness of the current situation and the funding base that is declining for the screening side of the program.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. And you got ahead of schedule. We were watching you on television and then had to run down here. So I am Senator Dianne Rosenbaum from District 21 and also the co-chair of the Women's Health and Wellness Alliance. And also significantly, I'm a breast cancer survivor, like Senator Joanne Berger and many other members and family members of people in the legislature. So I'm here just to remind you that this committee did pass two bills out of the legislative session, and we thank you very much for that, one of which would have expanded the number of slots for screening for the women that we're talking about today. And we didn't get that bill all the way through, but I think today, and the reason I really wanted to introduce this panel is because the situation has become truly dire, and we're talking about many emergencies, obviously, at a tough time for the state, but this one is one that just is unthinkable. So you probably know and just heard from Catherine
that we have only been serving 6,000 of the 57,000 women who are eligible in Oregon to be screened for breast cancer. So when you think about the number of women that are not being served, you know, not getting an early breast cancer diagnosis when their breast cancer would be most treatable, that's bad enough. But then when you now think about the fact that because of this match problem, because of the way Oregon has handled our requirement of doing a $1 match for every $3 of federal funds, because we have relied on the wonderful advocacy groups, including the Komen Foundation, they're in the room today, and the Cancer Society and others, and because those charitable organizations can't pull the whole load, we are facing a situation of now reducing those treatment slots from 6,000 by potentially probably about another 1,600 to 2,000 women that we won't even be serving next year at that level. So I think what we're presenting to you today, and you'll hear more information in a minute about the DMAP aspect of this, is that of all the many tough choices that this legislature has faced and potentially will be facing, this is not one that we want to have to be telling low-income women, you go to the back of the line that you were already at the back of, you go even further to the back of the line to learn that you may be healthy or you may have breast cancer at the stage when it can be treated. Because ultimately, it is true that those women will find out eventually, the ones who are breast cancer victims like me, and they're going to find out later, and many of them, unfortunately, will either receive no treatment or receive treatment at a stage that it's too late to do any good. And I don't mean to put, you know, tears in your eyes today, but it puts tears in my eyes to think of how lucky I was to get an early diagnosis, to have great insurance, as you all do, and to be able to be treated here in Salem during the 2005 session. So I just ask you to think about this situation, put a face on it, think of the women that you all know in your lives that you care about, women breast cancer survivors, breast cancer victims, and cervical cancer too, and don't, you know, work with us to find a solution to this. Thank you.
Thank you. I have a question. How many screenings did you do, and then how many diagnoses?
The average of Senator Mona Sanderson and committee, the average is that we do about 6,000 a year, and approximately 100 women are diagnosed with breast and cervical cancer. Approximately 100. 100. I believe that's correct.
Madam Chairman and members of the committee, yes, I think over
and
the
introduce yourself.
Oh, okay. Again. My name is Jean Phillips, and I'm the Deputy Administrator for the Division of Medical Assistance Programs. And during the last state fiscal year, we had about 125, I believe, women that were transferred over or referred over to our program and provided coverage under the breast and cervical cancer medical coverage under the Oregon Health Plan.
Go ahead.
Okay. And Madam Chairman, when the screening program first went into place, the option under Medicaid didn't exist. And then there was a law passed by Congress in about 2000, I believe it was. And here in Oregon, the legislature in 2002 addressed that option that was available to the state, and we put our program into place in about April of 2002. And the reason Congress passed that bill was because for all the women that were screened, a lot of them, especially the uninsured, didn't have treatment options once after they had gotten the diagnosis. And so the program was created and allowing states, like I say, to participate in the program on an optional basis. So to be eligible for the Medicaid coverage, they must be found in need of treatment. They can't be covered by a private major medical insurance coverage. They have to have income under 250% of the federal poverty level, and they have to be under the age of 65. They, once they're found eligible, they're eligible for the OHP Plus, which is the most comprehensive benefit package under the Oregon Health Plan, and they remain eligible for that program until the doctor provides a statement to us saying that they no longer need treatment. Currently, we have about 400 women that are participating in the program. Our budget is about $27 million, and I'd really like to point out that the bulk of that is federal funds, $20 million. We get an enhanced match rate for this program. Mm-hmm. And that concludes my remarks, Madam Chairman.
All right. Thank you very much. I know that this will be an issue. There will be a bill or a request or...
I don't think we have a definitive answer to that. I can tell you that on the list of agency programs that are offered up for savings,
yeah,
this program is on that list. And I think what we're highlighting for you today is that already we're in trouble with this program. And on the screening side in particular, we're in trouble because we have found, I think that, I don't know if Catherine said this before I got here, but we have found some ways to make up the reduction in private funds through the end of this year, but there is nothing actually on the horizon for next year. So starting July 1st of this summer, we are looking at a massive reduction in this program. Mm-hmm. And so we need to figure out some way to not have that happen.
Okay.
And I think that's what we're extending to you today. Right. We would like you to be partners in finding a solution.
Thank you. I'm sorry that the one of our Ways and Means people had to step out because he needs to hear this also.
Right. And just, I think in closing, Madam Chair and member of the committee, I hope that the charts that we've given you today are helpful, because I know that this program is a little bit complicated, and we were really, I think, trying to find ways to lay out how this match works, where the money is coming from, in ways that would be clear for people that need to understand it. And so...
Excellent.
I mean, any feedback you have about whether this is clear and whether we could do something a little differently, we'd love to hear that too.
No magic wands.
Well, I mean, I mm-hmm. suppose the magic wands have already been waved of trying to leverage as many private dollars as we possibly can. And I think, you know, Oregon is a standout in being able to raise money for breast cancer. You know, the Susan G. Komen Foundation in particular has done a remarkable job. But I don't really think by passing the hat we're going to be able to solve this one. So
thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And the final item on our agenda is removing prohibition against local government imposition of taxes on tobacco products. And Commissioner Cafori and Morgan Cowling, I'm not sure who you all want up here, Michael Novak, Brett Hamilton, and Beverly May had all signed up. Yeah.
We have a panel for you.
All right.
Should I get started? Thank you. My name is Deborah Cafori. I'm a Multnomah County Commissioner. Thank you, Chair Mona Sanderson. And I'll repeat, Senator Rosenbaum, member of the committee, Senator Morse. Thank you for allowing us the opportunity to testify before you today on a bill that would remove the preemption on local tobacco taxes. Multnomah County is the largest county in Oregon, population-wise, and we provide services to more than 700,000 residents. Our core county services include public safety, mental health and addiction, disability services, programs for seniors, and a host of other services that support the most vulnerable and needy in our community. Like many jurisdictions across Oregon, Multnomah County has faced more than a decade of budget cuts. Even in the times when the state of Oregon has had money, Multnomah County has been in cut mode. And in real terms, that has meant fewer dollars for the important community services that I spoke about prior.
As we are about to start this short and sweet February session, we've been told that now is not the time to bring forward this bill, and I believe that this is exactly the time that we need to bring forward this bill. Multnomah County, like most jurisdictions, has very few options for raising revenue, and we simply need more tools to take care of our own citizens. I want to take a quick moment to address a common concern that I've heard from several of our colleagues as we've been talking about this bill. They're worried that a tax increase in one county will drive folks to go purchase their products in other counties. So we did a survey in my office, and we called around to find out how much cigarettes cost, and we found the prices range even within neighborhoods. For example, a pack of Camel Lights cost $4.89 at Plaid Pantry, while they cost $6.59 at Safeway. That's almost a $2 difference. The same exact product costs $5.95 at 7-Eleven. So what this demonstrates to me is that consumers don't need to cross county lines to save money. They can simply cross the street. But they don't, because most people purchase this product at the place that is the most convenient. I applaud your willingness to consider this bill and give local governments, like Multnomah County, another tool to meet the needs of our residents. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thanks. Good afternoon, Chair Monica Anderson, Senator Morse. My name is Morgan Cowling, and I'm a policy manager for the Association of Oregon Counties. And we, too, support the removal of the preemption on local governments to enact a tobacco tax. For, while there are many reasons why we might support this, the main is local control. And it's local control for two reasons. One, it gives a revenue-raising option, just like Commissioner Kafoury mentioned, for some of our counties that are struggling financially, and not just the counties that are losing the federal timber payments, but for many reasons. And two, it also gives counties the ability to make local decisions that's in the best interest of their community around public health. And what I mean by that is that one county may decide to enact this and pass it and raise some revenue, while another smaller county may still want to have the public health benefits that you get from increasing price and deterring consumption. And studies show that especially youth are much more price sensitive. So there are two primary reasons, that, but all around the idea of local control, that we're supportive of this legislation. I would say that while that's really important, I don't think this provides a silver bullet or one solution for any county, and that we all need to continue working on other tools in the toolbox for counties to meet both the public safety and public health needs of their communities. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Briefly, Chairman Anderson, Senator Morse. For the record, my name is Michael Novak. I'm with the League of Oregon Cities, and I'm here today to express the League's support of rescinding the preemption on local governments imposing taxes on cigarette and tobacco products. As my colleagues here, I want to echo their words as well as say that this would grant local governments greater authority and their revenue-raising abilities, and really provide a vital tool for local that local governments haven't had access to for decades. So instead, the cigarette tax has been part of the state shared revenue system, which was imposed by the state with a percentage distributed to local governments. Now, Oregon's first cigarette tax was passed by a vote of the people in the 60s, and that measure dedicated 25% for counties, 25% for cities, and 50% for state property tax relief. And the cigarette tax failed at the ballot six times previously and passed only after a local dedication was added. And the ballot explanation stated that the cigarette tax, quote, would be an additional source of revenue for cities and counties. And city shares were considered compensation for preempting the local government's authority to impose this tax. And local government cigarette tax percentage has decreased substantially since the vote in the 60s. Originally, it was 25%. Currently, it's closer to 1.7%. And the city's portion of the cigarette tax helps fund critical basic services in large and small cities. And cities in Oregon are experiencing budgetary shortfalls in nearly every aspect of their revenue. They're making deep cuts in public safety, workforce, fire protection, and other public services, and funding gaps will continue to expand unless other options are found. And removing this preemption for local governments gives cities an important and vital tool to meet local community needs. It's a modest but important first step. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Questions? Yes. Senator Morris.
Thank you, Madam Chair. How much would Multnomah County expect, if you had the preemption lifted, to raise? What kind of a tax, and how much would you raise?
Thank you, Senator Morris. We haven't had a discussion among our colleagues yet as to we haven't put the cart before the horse yet. We thought we'd actually get it passed first. But we've done some research, and we've found that an increase of about 20 to 25 cents would mean between $6 and $8 million for Multnomah County, which is, ironically, the amount of the structural deficit that we currently have. So it's about the amount that we, even in good times, even when the economy is roaring full steam ahead, that's about how much we have to cut on an annual basis from our budget.
I did hear some complaints from small businesses saying, this is anecdotally, that this would hurt their business, but I think I heard some testimony saying that this really doesn't.
Well, and we had heard that along with the concern of having a patchwork of prices, so that people would, if we raise the tax in Multnomah County, people would just go across the line to Clackamas or Washington County to purchase cigarettes. And so that's why we did the study, and to find that there was, I was personally very surprised to find that in two stores basically right across the street from each other, there is almost a $2 price difference. So I personally think that a 25-cent increase, most people, I'm not saying that they won't feel it when they're paying it, but I don't know that that's going to put anybody out of business. I think that's a stretch.
Thank you. No further questions? Yes, Senator Chris.
I remember a few years ago when the state increased cigarette tax. At that point, Washington had a higher tax than Oregon did, and we did it theoretically to generate more revenue. But what we discovered is it didn't, because people who had been crossing the river to buy cigarettes in Oregon quit doing it because there's no advantage anymore. So it was basically revenue neutral. So one could assume that if we go higher than the state of Washington, the reverse might happen. And while the revenue for Multnomah County potentially might be higher, the big picture revenue to the state would decrease. I mean, just looking at what happened once and assuming it happens again. So, I mean, I guess when you can't look at static model, you have to look at human behavior and what people are going to do.
When we have a bill, we'll actually have a revenue impact statement.
So, well, Madam Chair, which is fine, except historically the revenue statements are based on static models assuming behavior doesn't change. That's what happened last time, and behavior clearly will change
because we want it to change. And I mean, I think that is the interesting piece of this bill, is it really is a two-pronged, and while I think the revenue raising is an important piece of it, it's equally important to talk about the public health aspect. And we have some folks who are going to talk after us to talk a little bit more about the public health aspect. But we think at Multnomah County that as you drive down the number of people that are smoking, and studies have shown that higher prices is a deterrent for young people to start smoking, which gets them on a path that they don't become smokers in later life. But that will help with health concerns and health risks down the line. So while it may mean fewer dollars than we expect, we would gladly welcome those fewer dollars, because that would mean we would have fewer smokers in our community.
Yeah, I can remember I once said if cigarette silver got above 35 cents a pack, I'd quit. So
we're still praying for you, Jeff.
We're here for you, Senator. We support you in that. Thank you.
All right. Brett Hamilton and Beverly May.
start?
Sure.
Madam Chairman, committee, thank you very much for giving us the time to talk about this important issue. I'm Beverly May, and I'm with Campaign for Tobacco-Free Kids. We're based out of Washington, D.C. I have the Western region, and Oregon is a priority state for me. I spend a lot of time in this beautiful state. And what Campaign for Tobacco-Free Kids, we are a leader that's working not only in the states but in the world to make sure that kid delaying the onset of youth trying to smoke by policy change, also environmental smoke, and helping people with cessation issues. And we know when we're talking about tobacco tax of any kind, youth are sensitive to the taxes, which means that delays their onset of starting. The longer they're delayed from starting, the chances are that they won't pick up the habit, and which is something that we certainly would like to see happen. The addictive power of cigarettes explains why every day 3,500 kids will start smoking. And they'll pick up these cigarettes for the first time, and out of that, 1,000 other kids will be addicted and continue to smoke and have smoking-related diseases. So I think that, and it's all in my testimony that you have, and I won't go through and belabor it, but I think that raising the tax is always something to look at as a win-win situation. You're certainly going to hopefully delay the onset. You're going to have adults and particular ethnic groups are sensitive to prices also, which means that they will quit smoking, which will save money for the community. Local government and cigarette tax rates, that's not something new. It's not something that hasn't been done before. Currently, there's 450 local areas that have, throughout the United States, that have taxes, which generate $590 million into the coffers for funding for the local communities. And so it's something that has been done. It's something we've also have found out that the tobacco industry doesn't seem to fight as much as they do a lot of times when the state taxes are presented. I don't know exactly the reason for that. It could be that there's a number of areas around the states and they choose their battles. I don't speak for the industry, so I don't know. But I know that that is something that when the local taxes are put up, that they are able to go through. Also, I think it's important to understand the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention estimates that smoking-related health costs and lost productivity is about $10.28 per pack of cigarettes nationwide. So when you think of the money that is being spent for one pack of cigarettes, we're spending on smoking-related diseases. In my testimony, you will see a list. It's a partial list of the cities and counties that have raised the tax. Certainly, I can get you more information. The experience that has happened in the cities is they have not lost money. The money that was spent on cigarettes would be spent on other things within the community. I'd like to leave you with a parting thought to remember that we're talking about youth not picking up a habit that could give them smoking-related diseases and could lose their life later on. We're talking about helping people that would quit because they're sensitive to the cost and also secondhand smoke to keep in consideration. So I personally thank you for your time and consideration. And if there's any questions?
Cook County in Illinois has a local cigarette tax of $2 per pack. You wouldn't have information on how many smokers they have in Cook County.
I can get that for you.
I think it would be very interesting to see what they say. There's always between 18% to 20% of the population that are smokers, and it would be interesting to just look at a couple of these to see, well, what is their actual rate if they have raised their tax so significantly. Have we really made a dent in preventing smoking? I mean, that would be my goal. That's why I would support this.
Well, why don't I get Cook County and I'll get a couple others on.
Yeah, it would be interesting. All right, thank you. Any other questions? All right. Thank you for coming.
Chairman Ross Anderson and members of the Senate Healthcare Committee. For the record, my name is Bart Hamilton, and I'm the Executive Director of the Tobacco-Free Coalition of Oregon. I'm here today to testify in support of removing the prohibition against government, local government imposition of taxes on tobacco products. TOFCO is a statewide not-for-profit organization that includes businesses, organizations, individuals who advocate for programs that will decrease the toll of tobacco in Oregon. And what I'd like to do is just share some stats with you. Nearly 7,000 Oregonians' deaths are contributed to tobacco, and that's from 2005. An additional 800 lives were taken from secondhand smoke. Just under 500,000 Oregonians currently smoke cigarettes, and 80% of those would like to quit. Yet some 16% of our kids are still continue to smoke. And this goes to relation of how we need to find a deterrent for that. The annual cost expenditure for productivity loss directly caused from tobacco comes to a number of $2.1 billion. 76% of Oregonians support a 60-cent tax on cigarettes, and that poll was done in June of 2009. 62% of Oregonians think tobacco tax to prevent smoking among kids and help smokers quit will be a very good idea, even when the discussion of a corporate tax and a tax on hospitals. So an increase in tobacco tax is a win-win-win solution. For Oregon, it's a win for health because we're reducing smoking and we're saving lives. It's a financial win because it raises revenues as well as reducing health care costs. And it's a political win because it's popular with the public. Thank you for your opportunity to testify before today, and I'll answer any questions.
Great. We're not sure that if this bill will come before, it'll probably go to the Revenue Committee, but I felt it was important for the Health Committee to hear this, and that's why I wanted to make sure that we had it on the agenda for today. So, yes, Senator Cruz.
And nowhere in here, I mean, I see lots of references to state and local taxes. What's the federal tax on cigarettes? The federal tax on cigarettes.
We just had an increase in the federal tax currently, but I don't know what the total of the federal tax is, but I can let you know.
Yes, it's listed here.
It is. What?
Yeah, from Richard Kosison. $10. For point of reference, here's a breakdown on a generic carton of cigarettes. Ace cigarettes, one carton. Manufactured charge for cost of goods, $9. Federal tax, $10. State tax, $11. Distributor profit, $1.
It's a little difficult a question to break out sometimes, but what we can attest to is that the tax now for Oregon is $1.18, and that puts us as number 27th in the nation as a tax. And as we expressed before, we know that tobacco tax, increase in tax, is a deterrent for smoking. And it's our position that not only produces revenues for Oregon, but as I said, it reduces costs, healthcare costs, a sum of $2.1 billion annually. Thank you.
Yes, Senator Bates.
You've heard all this stuff before, so I'm not going to repeat it. I'll just give you a couple little anecdotes that might be interesting to hear. You know, most of the health care costs that are avoidable are not because of what doctors do. It's 40 or 50% of it is personal choice. And of that 40-50%, the vast majority is whether you smoke or don't smoke. Cisco and a couple other large corporations that are self-insured have started a three-year program. They began 2 years ago. But if you smoke, they will disinsure you at the end of the third-year cycle, and then you will be fired. You will lose your job. There's going to be some challenges on whether they can fire you over that basis, but it looks like they probably can do it. The public's getting it. They're moving along. I think you're going to see more and more restrictions. There's no question, anecdotally in my practice, that the elevation of the cost of cigarettes through taxation and ending the ability to smoke in the workplace has made a huge change in people quitting, especially people over the age of 30. Young people still get, you know, I can do this and get away with it. I'm immortal and I'll do fine. It's not going to be a problem, and I can quit anytime I want to.
none of which is true. But it's very interesting to see what's going on. We're seeing a real sea change. Finally, it's just a piece of it. Mm-hmm. I'll support it, of course. I hate cigarette smoking. I'll support it. But I see the net results of it every single day in my practice. I'm just sick of it. So thank you for bringing it forward.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for your time.
All right.
All right. With that, we are done with the agenda. And yes, I want to read into the record. Rich and Ryan Inc. They gave us testimony opposed to this concept of the prohibition, and also from Oregon Neighborhood Store Association. So that's in the record.
Maybe.
Okay.
You want to let Richard come up and talk, or?
No, I don't think we need testimony on it, since we do have a tour that we need to get to. But and we are also not. This isn't the committee that'll be voting it out. Anyway, if that's all right.
Okay.
All right.
I think we're done.
All right, colleagues. In May, we will have, we're going to be here on Tuesdays and Thursdays, and I believe it's 8 in the morning that we're supposed to be here on Tuesdays and Thursdays in February. And then we will be, in the interim, we will be meeting 1 week in May. I think it's the third week, maybe the last week. We just were given those dates last night. And then in September, and then in December. And so I wanted to make sure that you put that on your calendar once you get those dates, because I really would love to have you all here. And so with that, we'll talk about the tour after I adjourn out. But if there's no other information, we are adjourned.
Just get warmed up.